Hello, noir mystery fans, and welcome to episode 7 of Thunder Road by Colin Holmes. I'm Gabe Shear, and this is Camcat Unwrapped. Previously on Thunder Road, Sharp crosses the desert from Fort Worth to Vegas only to find Doyle back in action.
Chapter 36. You are a hard man to find, Major. Sharp suppressed his surprise. Cartwright gestured to the front seat. Well, I've been out of town. Hop in. Sharp settled inside the gray Plymouth. You know, that man back there has had me looking all over for you. That's been taken care of. Cartwright wheeled them out of the empty parking lot. By you or the Central Intelligence goons? Cartwright guffawed and slapped the steering wheel as they turned out onto the highway. I knew you were the right man for the job, Sharp. Very few people have figured out the CIA. It was then he noticed the major had a general's star on his collar. Promotion? Of sorts. That was a temporary demotion for security purposes. We discovered very early on that people will tell a major a great many things they'd never tell a brigadier. He slowed the Plymouth and turned onto an unmarked road, away from the safety of the city. Shouldn't we be going towards town? I'm at the El Grande. Well, that depends on the answer to my question. Do you still have the item I sent you? Cartwright was much more interested in the road. The tinfoil? Sharp instinctively put a hand to his jacket. Cartwright nodded a smile. Tinfoil? It does look a little like tinfoil, doesn't it? Sharp felt the crinkle through the lining and hesitated. He'd been trusted with it by the major, but if being a major was a lie, could he trust him now? He went with the gut feeling only two men who've been through the crucible of war together can know. It's in my pocket. The question is, why is it in my pocket? Cartwright lit a Raleigh, cranked his window down a half inch, and blew his smoke out. I needed an ace in the hole. Things in Fort Worth were moving quickly, too quickly. I needed to make sure I had some leverage, in case things got difficult. The CIA guys? Yeah, they can be difficult. Sharp's hand went to the tender spot on his scalp. What's going on, Major? General? I've got some of this pieced together, but not all of it. Sharp lit a Lucky and cracked open his vent window. All in due time, Cartwright said as the headlights illuminated a cyclone fence. A white sign with large red lettering announced that they were entering a live firebombing range, and visitors were prohibited unless cleared by the facility commander. The lone guard checked Cartwright's ID and saluted. He handed Sharp a clipboard. Sharp gave the document a cursory glance. That won't be necessary, Cartwright stated. The corporal took the clipboard and stepped back crisply. Yes, sir. No record of this visit. Understand? Cartwright said. Sir, yes, sir. The tone in Cartwright's voice almost made Sharp salute. The general put the car in gear and pulled out. Sharp looked back to see the corporal still standing at attention. General, if you don't mind, I have a few questions. Oh, no, you'll have a million questions, and I likely can't answer most of them. But I'll tell you what we know. Cartwright slipped his ID wallet into his breast pocket, which is far too little. 5 minutes later, they came to another fence. This one had signs saying it was electrified and that trespassers would be shot. Concertina wire was coiled along the top, and it stretched into the night in each direction. Klieg lights burned in the darkness atop a 25-foot tower with a mounted machine gun. Sharp-noted guards with Army Ranger flashes on their shoulders, including the three he could see in the tower. He could still smell the paint. It all looked brand spanking new. Cartwright stopped the car and motioned for Sharp to get out. "This is starting to look serious, Jerry." The captain appeared from the tower. He snapped to a nervous salute. "General Cartwright, sir. We weren't expecting you, sir. Process this civilian, but make no record of this visit. Secure his sidearm." Sharp submitted to the body search and reluctantly surrendered his Colt. Neither Cartwright nor he mentioned the tinfoil. Back inside the Plymouth, Cartwright pointed a thumb behind them as they passed through another fence and gate about 100 yards inside the outer fence.
"You're partly responsible for that. Your damn digging has ruffled some very important feathers."
"It did?" Sharp was genuinely curious. Cartwright nodded.
"I was supposed to just disappear, but you wouldn't let it go. I should have just paid Doyle and been done with it, but I got rushed out of town. I was putting out fires, and by the time things settled down, you were in county tax offices and army personnel offices, trying to uncover all the tracks we'd buried to make me disappear."
"I have a talent for messing up other people's plans," Sharp admitted.
"So I've seen." The major turned general gave him a frown as the desert rolled by in the darkness.
"Why not just send it straight to Doyle?" Sharp asked. Cartwright took a drag from his smoke. "Do you trust Doyle? His relationship with Lansky made that too risky."
"I have to deal with them, but I do it as infrequently as possible."
"How exactly is the mob tied into this?"
"Part of the CIA program. We need a viable cover. Lansky had an operation in place through the Flamingo," Cartwright explained.
Sharp looked out the window, wondering what was beyond the darkness and how much darker this got.
"So what happened to Bugsy?"
Cartwright shifted in the seat.
"Mr. Siegel had a difference of opinion about how the operation should be run. Accounting irregularities were found."
"The mob doesn't account for skimming? I'd figure that would be a cost of doing business with the ethically challenged members of society."
Sharp lit another cigarette. This was a long drive, but there seemed to be a glow on the far horizon.
Cartwright checked his watch.
"It's one thing to take a little of Meyer Lansky's seed money. He understands a certain amount of grease is necessary to keep wheels moving. It's quite another to pocket most of the operating budget of a brand new governmental agency."
"So the CIA and the mob kill Bugsy Siegel in Beverly Hills and get it covered on every newsreel and front page in the country? Quite the covert operations group you've got."
General Cartwright chuckled.
"Well, I'm trying to limit assassinations. It's one of the reasons you were let go after they found out you didn't know anything."
"I didn't know anything," Sharp admitted. "They beat the tar out of me before I figured out your code games."
"Well, you know enough now." Cartwright squinted through the windshield.
"Like why you got knee-walking, commode-hugging drunk at the Four Deuces?"
Sharp blew a stream of smoke at the vent window.
Cartwright shook his head. "Not one of my finer moments."
Sharp looked at him in the glow of the dash lights. He seemed genuinely troubled by the incident.
"Oh, your secret's safe with me."
The general remained focused on the highway into the darkness.
"Yes, I guess I have to count on that."
His head turned and he examined Sharp as if he were choosing a steak at the butcher shop.
"You know, I spent the war in a cockpit and a POW camp. I missed the hell on earth some guys saw. That afternoon was the first time I'd ever seen anything truly shocking."
Sharp thought for a bit. He was right.
The flyers shot up trains and planes from 1,000 feet away. They didn't see nearly the horrific faces of war the way the infantry grunts did. Sharp's nightmares spoke to the things he'd never shake. The general looked in the rearview mirror. It'd be best if no one ever heard about that afternoon. Hey, Leo called your base commander, not me. Yes, late Colonel Grayson. Late? Automobile accident. Sharp swallowed hard and changed the subject. So Lansky needed somebody to run his Las Vegas operation after they took out Bugsy? Cartwright looked relieved to talk about mundane things like organized crime. I suggested Doyle.
You did?
I owed him. And after the turf war started in Fort Worth, I thought I could offer him an out. Then Capples got killed and screwed up just about everything. There was exasperation in Cartwright's voice.
Especially for Gentry, Sharp remembered.
Damn shame. And totally unnecessary. But Doyle and Gentry both wanted Capples gone. Gentry got hooked on the action in Europe and needed his fix. It was not an elegant solution.
And it got Gentry killed by Lansky?
It looked like that, but no. The CIA piled up quite the impressive body count trying to find your tinfoil. Sharp watched the growing darkness roll by. Who all knows what's going on here?
Doyle? Leo? Sharp asked.
No one is supposed to know the entire story. Leo certainly doesn't, even though he thinks he does. And Doyle has only seen the Las Vegas end of things. There are one or two people in D.C. who know most of it, but the whole key is compartmentalization, Cartwright explained.
Well, I know all that, so do I know what's going on?
Sharp stubbed out the butt of his lucky in the Plymouth's half-full ashtray. You've put quite a bit of it together, and now you're in for a penny and a pound. Cartwright chuckled, but Sharp didn't see anything funny about it. Only a half dozen people truly know the whole story. Maybe.
Plus that congressman? Sharp asked.
Cartwright nearly wrecked the car.
What gives you that idea?
I think that's Leo's in. Cartwright got visibly angry. Johnson. That son of a bitch. I wondered how Leo figured this out.
Sharp nodded. Leo knows people.
People who ought to be able to keep their yaps shut. It is Johnson, isn't it? Leo was in tight with FDR, and now he can't get to Truman, so he's cultivating his own inside man. Damn it. I should have seen that.
Cartwright thumped a palm on the steering wheel. Leo tells me Johnson will be senator come November.
Sharp led his witness. That's the plan.
Sharp got a cold chill. The plan?
You should forget you heard that phrase, Cartwright said.
Chapter 37. The glow at the end of the highway had become buildings in the lights. A lot of buildings. The blue and white strobe of a manned control tower and bombers turning off onto runways. A gigantic B-36 taxied through the lights. A couple of C-47 cargo aircraft sat off of the apron. Canvas-covered deuce-and-a-half trucks and jeeps zipped everywhere. It was damned busy for the middle of the night. They paused at an intersection as two flatbeds loaded with lumber and construction materials cut across, followed by a bus full of GIs. A small sign pointed ahead and read Area 49. Another sign pointed left toward Area 50. Cartwright turned right. There wasn't a sign.
You've got a lot going on here, General. Working all night?
Sharp looked back at the busy intersection. 3 shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The hills around a natural box canyon were a beehive of activity. Giant dump trucks emerged from an enormous excavation site. They were loaded with dirt.
Huge light standards surrounded the entire place. There must have been 50 acres under construction, not including the dozen or so Quonset huts and the tent city that stretched into the night. Sharp was impressed. That's a whopper of a hole in the ground. It'll be a quarter of a mile deep when it's finished. Cartwright slowed for another MP checkpoint and flashed his credentials. Damn, what are you burying?
Everything we can.
Back to not giving straight answers, General? Sharp's head was on a swivel, taking in everything he could see in the darkness.
I am. You just don't know all the questions yet.
Cartwright steered them to a complex of four aircraft hangars. They parked in front of the farthest one. It was twice as large as it looked from a distance, with doors that would easily take a B-36. Sentries posted all around the compound stood guard, fully armed, like they were expecting the Germans to come over the hill any minute now. Cartwright stepped from the car and waved a hand at a couple of rows of identical small houses.
This is temporary housing for the aeronautics people. We're bringing in the best aviation minds we can find.
He pointed to another vast concrete slab that was being poured. It looked bigger than a football field.
Over there will be electronics and computers. Bell Labs is moving some of their brightest people here, as are Sperry and Westinghouse. Eisenhower calls it the military-industrial complex, but he doesn't know what's going on here and what the ramifications are.
Sharp stopped in his tracks and waved to the construction surrounding them.
Ike doesn't know about this.
The general paused at the door.
The only people who know are those who need to. If they know and shouldn't, we make arrangements.
Arrangements. Sharp looked around.
Where exactly do I fall in those arrangements?
But Cartwright was already up the steps, opening the door of the hangar's office.
Welcome to the rabbit hole, he said.
They stepped into a garden-variety army office. A lieutenant typed away at a government-issue desk. A four-drawer file cabinet sat in the corner with a coat and hat tree and a steel trash can. One other door waited on the left side of the room. Sharp had been in these offices 100 times in everything from tents to Quonsets to palaces all over Europe. The lieutenant handed Cartwright some pink message slips, and he read them while the aide fingerprinted Sharp. He used rubbing alcohol and a rag to clean off the ink. The general handed one slip back to the lieutenant.
Call Kelly Johnson in Burbank and see if he can move that up to Friday. I'll need...
The phone on the desk jangled, interrupting him. It looked like a regular phone, but it had a row of buttons across the bottom. Sharp had never seen that. One lit up when it rang. Neat trick. The lieutenant lifted the handset and punched the button.
Liberty 4301.
He punched a red button on the phone and handed the handset to Cartwright.
It's for you, sir.
Cartwright took the handset and nodded. The lieutenant punched the red button again. Cartwright listened to a one-sided conversation and winced.
Damn it, they're not supposed to be here until tomorrow. Pass them through, but take your time. Make sure he knows this is our show, not his.
He cradled the handset. All the lights and buttons on the phone went dark. He motioned Sharp to follow. They stepped through the office and through what he thought was a closet door, but led to a hallway that turned to another hallway. About the time Sharp felt like a mouse in a maze, they stepped into the hangar. He'd been in more than a few hangars. He'd been through the bomber plant in Fort Worth on a public tour for vets after the war. He'd been to a goat roping, a rattlesnake roundup, and upside down in a Curtiss biplane. Nothing prepared him for this. Hundreds of workers bustled about. Civilians in white shirts and ties, military in khakis with no insignia. Sharp stepped to the railing. They were on a platform that looked out over the space. As much as he had seen above ground outside, that much was buried below the surface inside. They hadn't climbed any stairs, but were three floors above the bottom level. Sharp gawked as they walked down three flights of stairs to an open bullpen of drafting tables, rows and rows of men hunched over them, scratching out drawings and slapping out calculations on slide rules. The general led the way to a knot of six men in a discussion at the end of the central aisle. A large man had his back to them and was making a firm point. He sensed their approach, and George Griffin turned around. He recognized Sharp instantly. "You son of a bitch!" Big George balled a fist and drew back, and Sharp got ready to duck with a strange sense of deja vu as three guys behind George grabbed him. Cartwright stepped between everyone. "Whoa, whoa, whoa. Griffin, stand down. What the hell is this?" George wilted. Then he stammered. He ruined my marriage." Cartwright was lost. He looked at Sharp. "You and Velma?" Sharp was insulted. "Are you kidding me? I was hired by Mrs. Griffin to tail George. I got some rather interesting pictures that..." "You took those?" The general ran a hand through his hair. "Oh, you are a pain in the ass." "What did I do?" Sharp held up his palms. Cartwright waved at the large engineer. "Griffin here is one of the best aerodynamicists in the business. That other woman you photographed is an agent for the British government. She was a covert liaison to the program, and we couldn't have her seen it consolidated. You screwed up a significant program." "Where is she now?" Sharp gritted his teeth. "Agent McGuire?" He looked at his watch. "Alice Springs, Australia." "Wow." It was not an enjoyable mess to clean up. He shook his head. "Griffin, I have a VIP on the way in. Can you see to him while I show Mr. Sharp around?" "Yes, sir." He really did look like a guy who had lost the love of his life. Griffin turned back to the engineers, and Sharp and Cartwright started down the aisle to where the building was divided by a wall of translucent sheeting. He shot the general a questioning look. "It's called plastic. It's a little like glass and a little like metal, a little like paper. And you can synthesize it out of petroleum. We're just starting to figure it out." They stopped at the door, and Sharp looked back at George. He'd recovered and was back into his heated discussion. "I'm almost afraid to ask. What happened to Velma?" The general paused. "Velma did not want to play ball. Thanks to a very recent change in Nevada state law," his look told Sharp that had been hard to arrange, "one can get a divorce or get married here in a matter of hours. Her name is now Henrietta, I believe, and she is this very week opening a bookstore in Fort Walton Beach, Florida." Sharp thought he was supposed to feel ashamed. He didn't. "That was quick. We can do amazing things. Here's one now." With that, they stepped through the plastic and into the vast open area of the hangar. That's where they kept the flying saucer. Chapter 38. The saucer was huge. It wasn't exactly a saucer, more oval, and the edges were rounded like the front of a thick airplane wing. It looked to be three stories tall in the center. He guessed it was 150 feet across. Sharp stood there. "Holy shit." "Yeah, we say that a lot," Cartwright chuckled. They walked up to the edge. The craft sat on legs that looked like they retracted into the outer shell. At the bottom of each of the three legs was a rectangular foot. The pads were about 2 feet by 4 feet. Sharp was confident the bottoms were covered in New Mexico ranchland dirt. The surface of the craft looked like a rubberized compound. It was a dull, dark gray finish that was scorched and pockmarked like it had been sandblasted and burned and beaten up. It had either been in New Mexico a long time, or traveling across the galaxy wasn't like going to Piggly Wiggly for groceries. Sharp ran his hand across it. Feels weird, doesn't it? It completely absorbs radar waves. Amazing stuff. The general was right, but amazing didn't begin to cover it. You were right about me having a million questions. Sharp peered under the leading edge of the craft. There's more. Sharp turned to lead him across the hangar. Sharp stopped. The tinfoil in his pocket had begun to warm up like it had at the hospital. He kept his mouth shut. The craft comprised a couple of layers that got smaller as they got closer to the top, which was a translucent dome. Shapes moved inside the dome, but Sharp couldn't make them out to be anything. Hoses and wires and cables ran all over the craft and from underneath. The general walked him around to a rollaway staircase that led up to a platform set against the side of the ship. Sharp was flummoxed. Then he noticed that everyone in the hangar had stopped to look at him and the general. Mostly Sharp. The 60 or 70 men stopped work and looked at him like he was the one from Mars. You guys get many visitors here, Jerry? Sharp pushed his hat back and scratched his head. Cartwright paused to sign a clipboard for a khaki-clad gent. More than I want. There's almost always someone here to see it. I expect Truman and the Majestic 12 sometime this week. Sharp had no idea what that meant. A team of scientists in white lab coats were in a very animated conversation on a platform to the far side of the craft. They pointed at the general and his guest. Cartwright nodded to them. Come on, I'll show you why you're a curiosity. On the far side of the saucer was what had to be the remains of another. Rusty Darnell had been right. There wasn't much left. The parts were laid out on the floor, and it looked like the 15 guys walking around in white doctor's coats were trying to reassemble it. They climbed a set of stairs to a platform erected next to the craft. The white coat team was excited. It's doing it again. The general introduced Sharp to a tall, balding gent with glasses, an unlit pipe clenched in his teeth, and a German accent you could hang a coat on. Dr. Dandermeyer, this is Jefferson Sharp. Jeff, Dr. Henry Dandermeyer. He's one of our lead astrophysicists. It's so very good to meet you in person, Dr. Sharp. It was a hearty handshake, and the scientist grasped his hand with both of his as if he was greeting a long-lost friend. In person? He had a suspicion the doctor's first name had once been Heinrich. I'm not a doctor, Doctor. I'm just a regular guy. Heinrich shook his head. No, you really aren't. You just may not realize it yet. Dandermeyer gestured to where several of these white coat types were looking at a large piece of black metal hanging on a support wall. They kept looking at Sharp and pointing at clipboards. One or two were arguing. Sharp was lost like a kid in a corn maze. The general led him over to the group. Dr. Dandermeyer's team is mostly theoretical physicists working on reverse engineering the technology of the ship. I'm a livestock detective from Fort Worth. I'm here to show you how. It seemed to be funnier to Sharp than the white coats. Cartwright pointed to the black wall. Usually this is covered with what the techs call snow. It's gray and grainy like a photograph of sand, but it moves. Dandermeyer leaned in. Earlier this month, one evening, with no warning, it went black. And then a human being appeared on the screen like it was a movie. We all saw it. It was fascinating. And then he disappeared. Until now. Sharp looked at him with a question. It was you, Mr. Sharp. You were on the screen watching us, looking at the Greys. They were fascinated by you. It was a seminal event in our progress. The Greys? Sharp had no clue. Dandermeyer looked puzzled and then horrified.
He's not been briefed? I had no idea.
It's all right, Henry, he's in. He just hasn't been briefed to Delta level yet. Come take a look at this. Cartwright took his arm. Do you still have the tinfoil? Sharp reached into the hidden pocket of his jacket, and when he pulled the now warming and stiff tinfoil panel out, the screen on the wall went wild with a moving kaleidoscope of colors. It spun and danced until he held the tinfoil in front of himself and looked into it. There on the wall in front of Sharp was Jefferson Sharp. It's a television, he said. I saw one at the state fair. Dr. Dandermeyer chuckled.
You did not see this at the State Fair of Texas.
Well, not exactly, but it's the same principle. You point the tinfoil like a camera and it shows it over there. Simple, Sharp explained.
I assure you, Mr. Sharp, it is anything but simple.
Sharp moved the tinfoil around and the doctor and the general came over to look into it and see themselves on the screen. They were like school kids playing with a new toy. The place had gotten very quiet. The lab coats were all looking at them, and as Sharp looked into the screen, he could see the three of them mugging for the camera. And behind them, the taller, larger gray head and insect eyes he'd seen on the screen at the hospital. The doctor and the general stepped away. Sharp turned slowly around and found himself face to face with a creature from outer space.
Jerry, that makes 2 million questions.
The creature's almond eyes focused on Sharp and its oversized head tilted ever so slightly. A long, thin finger touched his chest.
What the hell? It said.
Sharp remembered the men's room at the hospital.
Yes. What the hell?
He nodded. The creature took the tinfoil from him. It looked at the fabric and then turned it over and pressed a small symbol on the back. Almost instantly, the screen went gray and the tinfoil went limp. The gray gave a slight bow of his head. Sharp did the same, and the alien reached out a slender hand. Sharp took it and shook his hand. The gray bowed again and then walked off the platform and back into the ship. The gray's skin was cool and moist and left a waxy, slimy film on his hand. The general stepped beside him.
You okay?
I think so.
Is this why you got drunk off your ass at the Deuces? Sharp asked.
Yep.
Got any left?
He looked at his hand and wiped it on his pants. Dr. Dandermeyer nearly died.
Don't! That's the most contact we've had with them. We'll want a sample.
Except it came out sounding like, we will want a sample.
Doc's right. That was as close to actual communication as we've had with the Greys. Cartwright gestured to his hand.
That was communication?
Sharp looked at his palm. Across the way, an officer in khakis was double-timing it across the hangar toward them. Cartwright thought a second.
You ever have a dog?
Sure, when I was a kid. Sharp thought that came from left field.
Ever want to be able to talk to it? Ask it how it was? What did it want for dinner, if it needed to go out?
Cart waved the aide up to the platform.
Of course, who wouldn't want a talking dog? Sharp said.
Man and dogs have been living together for thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years, Cartwright explained.
Yeah.
Sharp had no idea where this was going. We still can't speak dog.
I hadn't thought about it, Sharp said.
Cartwright nodded toward where the gray had disappeared into the saucer.
Well, in this case, we're the dog.
The aide arrived.
Sir, he's here.
Here at the front gate or here at the hangar? Cartwright frowned. Here at the hangar, sir. Damn, that was fast. He was supposed to be in St. Louis. Cartwright was visibly annoyed.
He flew himself, sir.
Figures. Cartwright hurried down the steps and Sharp followed, mostly because he had no clue what the hell he was supposed to do now. Cartwright looked over his shoulder as they headed toward the plastic wall.
I told you we were getting the best aeronautics people we could find?
Yeah.
Some are more difficult to deal with than others.
They went through the plastic wall back into the engineering spaces, and George Griffin backed toward them, trying to wrangle a handful of men in dark suits and one man in a leather flying jacket and a fedora. Sharp recognized the face and a pencil-thin mustache from the newsreels. It was not George's best moment.
Mr. Hughes, we really didn't expect you until tomorrow. The general has prepared an indoctrination so that you can familiarize.
Does it fly? Said Howard Hughes. I'm probably more familiar with it than he is.
George was trying.
Well, this isn't really like...
Hello, Howard. Cartwright saved his butt.
Jerry, what the hell is going on? You tell me it's a national security issue and to come see it. Then when I get here, they don't even want to let me land.
Hughes was direct.
We didn't expect you until tomorrow. I really need to brief you beforehand. This is highly out of the ordinary.
Cartwright stepped between Hughes and the door. Hughes looked at him, then walked right by and through the plastic wall. Sharp followed to see what was happening, and nobody stopped him. Hughes was already studying the saucer and yelling to no one in particular.
What the hell is this, Jerry? Is this Northrop? Did Jack do this? After that flying wing bullshit, I can see him doing a saucer.
Sharp watched the aircraft genius in Hughes come out. He'd seen a newsreel showing Hughes breaking the transcontinental speed record in a plane of his own design. And then, when the Army didn't want to buy it as a fighter, Hughes said the Japanese copied much of the design to build their Zero. The man knew airplanes. Hughes was under the craft, running his fingertips over the surface of the hull.
Jack's work has improved. I can't even feel the rivets. That's tight.
He nodded in admiration.
How the hell did he seam these? There's not even a butt joint? And where's the propulsion?
Hughes never noticed the gray who had come down to investigate on his own.
There's no intake, and if it's a jet, there has to... Jerry, is this thing atomic? I read a paper last month on...
He backed into the alien. Hughes spun to see who had gotten in his way. The gray was a foot taller than the millionaire pilot, and the shock to Hughes's system was apparent even to Sharp 15 yards away. The gray stood up straight, then gave the same head bow he'd given Sharp and offered his hand. Hughes's eyes went wide, and he took the hand by reflex. The gray gave a simple handshake, then turned and walked back to the ramp leading up into the craft. Hughes looked at his hand. He began to tremble, and his eyes widened even more. Sharp watched him shrink back into his jacket. He pulled out a handkerchief and began to scrub the film from his hand. Sharp looked at his own hand. It reminded him a little of handling a fish. But Hughes was scrubbing furiously. His head jerked from side to side, looking from the group to the spot he'd last seen the gray and back again. Cartwright spoke for everyone, watching the man come apart.
Oh, shit.
He ran to Hughes, who was shaking like a leaf.
Howard, it's all right. Everything is under control. It's A-OK.
What? Is that... Was that a...
Yes, it was. Let's get you a chair.
Cartwright put his arm around the millionaire and began to steer him to a desk nearby.
Chair.
Hughes blew out a shaky breath.
Now, Howard, I need you to take some deep breaths.
Cartwright settled him into a desk chair. Hughes slumped forward, stealing looks over his shoulders and all around. The general looked from Hughes to Sharp and back again.
This is why we do the indoctrination. If you're not ready for it, this can be difficult, said the voice of experience. Sharp got it. He'd had a little preparation, halfway expecting something like this since the evening Gentry died. Maybe it was because he'd seen some really gruesome things in his life. Maybe since he'd seen the graze on the tinfoil in a hospital bathroom, he was a little harder to shock than the average Joe. Or Howard.
Where's Odie?
Hughes's voice was hollow. Cartwright's face was a question. Odie?
Odekirk! Get me Odie!
One of the dark suits stepped forward.
Yes, sir, Mr. Hughes?
Hughes rose from the chair to a hunch and then grabbed the man's arm. Cartwright tried to intervene.
Howard, let me help you.
Hughes couldn't even see the general.
Odie, get me out of here.
Yes, sir, Mr. Hughes.
They walked toward the stairs, Hughes trembling and stealing looks back over his shoulder, Sharp and the general behind them. Two of the Greys had come down to watch. That seemed to draw Hughes back, but then he retreated.
We'll need a base of operations here, Odie. What's that town?
Las Vegas, Mr. Hughes.
Las Vegas. We'll need to set some people up here to review this. I'll want to be involved. This will be big.
Hughes looked at his hands, still wiping with the handkerchief.
Plan on a long-term project. Keep my name out of it, for now.
They had made it through engineering and to the stairs. Sharp was trailing the group and tapped one of the dark suits on the shoulder.
Is he going to be all right?
I don't know. I've never seen him like this. Sharp and the general followed them out and watched the four cars of Hughes's motorcade tear across the desert, the dust hanging in the headlights of each trailing vehicle. They both lit cigarettes as they watched the lights disappear. Cartwright blew smoke toward the stars.
So, he asked, got any questions?
Chapter 39. Jerry turned the Great Plymouth onto the road they'd come in on.
Well, what do you think?
Think? What's to think? We just whipped the whole damn planet in a war, and now we find out there are other planets out there?
Sharp shook his head.
It's a lot to take in.
High school algebra was a lot to take in. This changes everything, Sharp said.
I think I remember telling you that.
What happens next, Jerry?
Truthfully, we're making this up as we go. You've put more of it together than I thought you would, and then you didn't quit. I convinced Martin that if we didn't tell you the whole shebang, you'd have half the world looking for this place. I think there'd have been a simple solution if you hadn't made the tinfoil work.
Cartwright accelerated away from the complex.
A simple solution?
The CIA wanted you dead. Then you showed up on the screen and established communication with the Greys. The scientists lobbied hard to keep you alive. Sure, you could be that communication link, Cartwright said.
Have I ever told you how much I like scientists?
No kidding. When I first came on board this project, it was just the crash site. We had no contact with the Greys. Then one morning at the site, two ships landed. I was the senior officer on site that day, so I took a jeep and went to meet them. It shook me to my core.
Cartwright focused on the darkness.
I remember that.
We got back to the base in Fort Worth, and I went straight to the bar, Cartwright said.
How'd they get here?
We worked out getting all the wreckage here for safekeeping, hidden from everyone, so we thought. Then, just like in New Mexico, one day they flew right in like they owned the place. That scared people.
Like the CIA? Sharp asked.
And a lot of others above my pay grade. There's a belief that the human race isn't ready for this news. That knowing the government can't protect us from the Greys and that the perception of limiting what Uncle Sam can do would be a bad thing.
that some people in Washington are more afraid of that than beings from outer space. Cartwright checked the rearview mirror. Sharp noticed the car was slowing down. He also noticed that sometime between the moment they walked out with Howard Hughes and right this minute, Brigadier General Jerome Cartwright had equipped himself with a sidearm. And Sharp's weapon was somewhere up ahead in a safe in a guard shack surrounded by 10 Army Rangers. No matter what was about to happen, it was not going to be a fair fight. "We need to talk, Sharp." Cartwright steered the car to the edge of the road. "Talk? Isn't that what we've been doing?" Cartwright stared straight ahead and Sharp looked around. This really was the middle of nowhere. "Do I have a choice?" "I'm afraid not. What we're doing here affects mankind. We can learn a lot from the Greys, but it will take years, maybe decades. It'll take hundreds, maybe thousands of men to do it." Sharp took a stab at it. "So it's the Manhattan Project all over? A hidden town in Nevada, but this one isn't hidden?" "We learned a lot from the Manhattan Project. This time it's hidden in plain sight. There's a viable cover, the atomic testing range. That should keep people away. And the city we're building across the desert will give those who can't leave a place to enjoy." He cocked his head in the direction of Vegas. "Those who can't leave?" Sharp parroted. "Howard Hughes just walked away." "Airplanes crash all the time. You'd kill the richest guy in the world?" There was a long moment, and Sharp shifted in his seat. The desert seemed colder at night. "We need you on this project, Jeff. You're the first link, the first real communications breakthrough we've had with the Greys. We need to study how you and they seem to be able to communicate."
"I don't know that I'd call it communicating. Dr. Dandemeyer and his team disagree. They think you may be a key to this."
"So you'd fly me back out here? How often?"
"You wouldn't be leaving." Sharp glanced at the automatic on the general's hip.
"I don't suppose I get a bookstore on the beach if I don't play ball."
"No."
Cartwright acknowledged the ultimatum. "This is it? The solution the CIA and the government have come up with? People who don't get on board get killed?"
"Or disappear."
The general nodded to the vast desert around them. "Is that what happened to you?" Sharp asked.
"At first, they weren't sure about me. Getting drunk and coming unglued didn't help."
Sharp nodded.
"That's when I sent you the tinfoil. When they came to discuss it," Cartwright's glance told Sharp there was a threat involved, "I mentioned that I'd passed the tinfoil along, and if they killed me, then others would come forward."
"That took some guts."
"Bluffing is easy when they know you're serious, and what you have is more powerful than they are," Cartwright said. The man understood the concept of blackmail better than most people who'd done it. The general was more fearless than he gave himself credit for. Sharp lit what he hoped wasn't his last cigarette.
"So, of the choices you've laid out, I'd rather not get killed. What now?"
"You need to join us on this program, work with our communications people, help us reach the Greys."
"Join you? You got a poker room in that big hole? I'm a civilian. What am I supposed to do?"
"I really don't want to go back to being a cop, and I'm definitely not going back in the army."
"We've got a viable cover for you. Casinos need security. Somebody who knows how to look for things. I'm told the Flamingo is looking for a guy, and it pays almost $25,000 a year," Cartwright said. That was more than Sharp had made in the last 5 years put together.
"What about Ronnie? She doesn't know anything about this. I've got nothing back in Fort Worth, but she's got family, friends, and a job. You can't keep her here. If I agree to this, she gets to go home like none of this ever happened. No bookstores or banishment to the Australian outback."
She's being talked through this same scenario right now.
Cartwright met his eyes.
Ronnie's a patriotic American, and this is a matter of national security. She's a sworn officer of the court. We trust that she can keep a secret. But know that this is her decision, not yours, not mine.
And if she doesn't want to play ball, because if you're talking the other option, I'm about to become very uncooperative.
Sharp's pissant cowhand jaw tightened.
We'll keep her here. There are incentives.
Cartwright smiled.
You need to know right now?
Yes, I do. There will be some documents to sign up ahead. Secrecy oaths you'll need to take very seriously, under penalty of death.
Cartwright's eyes were as cold as stones.
Sharp thought a second. Nobody would believe me anyway.
Cartwright grinned.
That's the general idea.
And I'd work for Doyle?
Unless you'd rather be somewhere else.
Cartwright's face showed they hadn't considered that.
Sharp let him off the hook. I think I'd start with the devil I know.
Is the whole town in on this?
Not everyone. Let's just say that the atomic bomb makes a very good cover story.
Wanda?
Sharp looked out the window to emphasize that he knew something.
The bartender? She's one of our best operatives.
She spotted you the second you walked into the El Grande, Cartwright said.
She needs to be better at not letting on. I knew I was getting into something from the way she acted, Sharp said.
I'll let her know. Are you in or not?
Cartwright wasn't going for his gun, so that was a relief.
Sharp looked out to the darkness. He lit a lucky and blew the first drag through the window and watched it fade into the desert night.
Yeah, I'm in. Sharp nodded. But I don't want to deal with those assholes from the CIA.
Me neither. I'm pressing Truman to limit their assignments to outside of the U.S.
You're pressing Truman?
Sharp was impressed.
Well, me and Mr. Hoover.
Oh, the FBI, that's much better.
Sharp chuckled. The general put the car in gear.
At least the FBI is somewhat predictable. The CIA wants to write their own rules.
They drove to the tower and Sharp signed his life away. Then he got his gun back.
It was a quiet ride back to town. Earlier, he'd thought he had a million questions. Now, he didn't think he could handle the answers. They parked at the entrance of the El Grande. Sharp started to get out, and Cartwright stopped him.
Don't forget about the trunk of the car.
Sharp watched the general disappear into the evening and remembered what Doyle had said about something in the back of the cord. The cowbell boy brought the car around, and Sharp wrestled the spare and the Continental kit out of the way. Sure enough, beneath the false panel was a beat-up leather briefcase. He bet his colt it had $7,100 in it. He tipped Kenny 50 cents and asked if he'd put the spare back in place. He seemed to be okay with that. Maybe this was going to work out well, he thought, right up until he got to the room. Sharp was all ready to go in and take a load off when the sound of voices came from the other side of the door. Two of them. Men. And they sounded enough like the guy he'd tagged in the bar.
He knows too much. Do we kill him or just make sure he gets the message?
The boss says we take him out.
Sharp eased the case to the ground, slipped the Colt from its hiding place, and slowly worked the key into the lock. He had the drop on these two and was betting they'd be associates of Billings and Martin. He was learning to hate the CIA. In one move, he shoved open the door and followed the 45 into the room. The perfectly straight, empty hotel room. The bed was made, the drawers were back in place. It was neat as could be. With a trumpet fanfare, the radio announced the Shadow would return after this message from 20 Mule Team Borax Soap Flakes.
The air went out of him like a balloon, and then the bathroom door opened. He spun around and leveled the gun right between the lovely eyes of Veronica Arquette. She gasped and nearly dropped the towel she was wrapped in. Sharp frowned, and then it got awkward.
"Damn it, Jeff! They said we were done with the guns!"
She spun into the bathroom while he tucked the Colt away and found his stammering voice.
"Sorry. I had no idea. What the hell are you doing here? Where'd you go? Who said we were done?"
She stepped back out, tying a robe around her. Obviously, she wasn't expecting visitors any more than he was expecting to be one.
"I got a message to meet you at the bar."
She pulled a cigarette from her purse, and he found the matchbook and lit it. Even scrubbed clean of makeup and with her hair piled up under a turban, she looked like a dream. But I knew something was up. She gave him that look. The one women use to tell you that you weren't getting away with whatever it was you thought you were getting away with.
"My message?"
"Yeah, you didn't write it, and I knew something wasn't on the level." He frowned.
"Then Doyle called for me. He was with Vernon Billings and an army colonel at the bar. They told me all about what you've been up to. I just wanted to help."
"I don't know what he told you, but Doyle doesn't quite know the entire story." Her lip quivered.
"Jeff Sharp, if we came all the way out here, spent all this damn time in the car, everything we've done, and you're going to be an ass,
Wait. What did they tell you?"
"They said you've uncovered something and it's a matter of national security. That they need you to help Jerry on a secret project."
Sharp ran a hand down his face. It wasn't exactly a lie.
"And they said you might need my help."
She took a seat on the corner of the enormous bed. A bare knee slipped from beneath the robe. Sharp shook out a lucky and lit up.
"Ronnie, this thing is huge, and it could be dangerous. I doubt they mentioned that." "In case you didn't notice, Jefferson, it's been dangerous for a while now."
"Yeah, but this is your chance to walk away. You don't have to do this."
"I know that."
She balanced her smoldering cigarette on the ashtray and came to him, meeting his eyes.
"I'm not agreeing to this because anyone says I have to."
She put her arms around his neck and gently planted her lips on his. The kiss promised a passion he didn't dare imagine she felt. And just as he began to loosen the robe's belt, they were interrupted by a knock at the door. They both looked to Sharp's jacket and the Colt hidden within. He nodded to the bathroom and she ducked inside. He slid a hand inside his jacket and leaned against the room door. "Who is it?"
"Hotel staff, sir."
Sharp put his hand on the Colt and positioned his boot as a doorstop. He cracked the door open. It was another cowbell boy, but not Kenny.
"Excuse me, sir, is this your case?"
He'd left the briefcase in the hallway. Sharp thanked him and brought it in. Ronnie cocked her head from the bathroom door.
"What is it?"
"Unless I miss my guess, it's a couple of $1,000.
"I guess running around with you does have an upside, Jefferson."
"And you're okay with that?"
"Are you?"
He set the case on the nightstand and scooped her into his arms. He spun around and deposited her on the enormous bed. "I am much more than okay with that." This time, the phone interrupted their moment. Sharp ignored it for the first dozen rings, but the bell didn't relent.
"What?" he barked into the receiver.
"Mr. Sharp?" He had a flashback to Bobby Capples answering the phone and paused. Ronnie bounced up and approached the briefcase.
"Who is this?"
"This is the Maitre d'. I'm to remind you of your dinner reservation."
He looked at Ronnie. She was staring into the case. Her mouth was gaping. He covered the mouthpiece.
"Did you make a dinner reservation?"
She shook her head.
"Nobody here made a reservation." The other end of the phone was dead. He got a wary feeling and hung up. When he turned back to Ronnie, she had pulled a small square Tiffany blue box from the briefcase. A crisp white bow adorned the box. She looked at Sharp, then the box, then him again.
Jeff, is this?
A cold shiver ran down his spine that made the one he'd had when the gray shook his hand feel like the warm fuzzies. Cartwright had given him an ultimatum about moving across the country and starting a new life, but there was something in that little box that would really change his world. He looked at Ronnie and made another life-altering decision. In a snap. It is.
Are you?
Her gaze started between his and the box. It seemed like the thing to do, so he dropped to a knee. I am. Will you? She looked deep into his eyes, but she didn't speak. His heart beat hard. It occurred to him that he wasn't just asking her to join him in a cute little bungalow back home in Fort Worth. She deserved the truth, and all of it he knew. Before you answer, there are a few things that you need to know. She put a finger on his lips.
I know we are not talking about a white picket fence, Jefferson. That much became clear to me in the last couple of days, and that is all I need to know.
She opened the box, and the ring was everything one would expect when you have a mobster picking out your jewelry. It was a little overdone. She gasped again.
Oh, Jeff.
If you don't like it, we can get something you...
It's perfect.
One thing he'd learned, Ronnie could be a little flashy. Honey, what I'm involved in, there's a lot to it. More than just...
Vern mentioned a secret government project. I understand.
We can't go back to Fort Worth, ever. We'd have to stay here. Sharp started an explanation he'd never get to finish.
I can live with that.
She admired the ring.
It is a tad gaudy, she said, but I can live with that too.
He opened the briefcase but didn't find $7,100 in there. It was more like 20 grand. The note inside, written in Doyle's familiar handwriting, said that Gentry wouldn't be needing it. Ronnie watched as he pulled wrapped bundles of cash out of the case and placed them on the bed.
This gets more interesting every moment. Any other surprises?
I hope not. I've about reached my limit. He set the last bundle on the bed and scratched his head.
It's been a lot to take in.
You have no idea. The phone rang again. I told you we didn't make a reservation. Doyle Deniker cut him off. No, I did. But take your time. I'm putting most of this on your room tab. The phone went dead in his ear. That was Doyle. He's waiting for us. He hung up the receiver.
Is this how it's going to be? Doyle always pulling our strings?
I have no idea, but we should at least go and tell him thanks for the wedding present. He nodded to the cash. He took the briefcase to the front desk and checked it into the hotel safe while Ronnie got herself ready. Then they walked to the Chuckwagon Buffet, where the maitre d' wore a Stetson and a bolo tie. It seemed the perfect place for an elegant dinner with the fiancé and new boss he hadn't had at breakfast. But the buffet buckaroo led them past the warming tables and chafing dishes. Doyle had a private dining room, and one of his gorillas opened the door and ushered them inside. The room actually was quite elegant, not a hint of Western wear in sight. Doyle and his companion Monica were chatting with the general and an attractive woman who was introduced as Mrs. Cartwright. Sharp raised an eyebrow at Jerry, and he just shrugged. He wondered what the man's real story was, and hers. A waiter brought champagne. Doyle raised his glass. A moment. For Gentry Ferguson. They paused, then toasted.
Sharp couldn't help but reflect on the serious nature of this business. He'd once thought that money was serious business. Now he knew some things could be much more valuable than money. Some were in a currency he couldn't yet fathom, and he didn't know if he ever would. The world had gotten smaller, the stakes larger, and the game had more than changed. They'd be making up rules as they went, and he'd have some interesting help to do it. Monica and Mrs. Cartwright admired the ring. "But where do we get married?" Ronnie asked. The general winked. "Sharp already took care of that."
"I did?"
He nodded. "Remember me telling you about Velma Griffin? How we had to get a state law put on the books for quickie divorces? The same law allows for expedited marriages here as well."
"So you can come to Las Vegas and get married, just like that?"
"Yep, you two can be the first to try it out."
"And probably the only ones. Who's going to elope to the middle of nowhere and get married?"
Sharp shook his head and took another glass from the waiter. It was one of the dumber ideas he'd heard in a while. Doyle gave him a smile.
"I'm betting there will be lots of folks."
Sharp laughed.
"Sure there will."
The mobster took a sip of champagne.
"Never argue with a man who can tell the future."
You have been listening to Thunder Road by Colin Holmes, narrated by Grover Gardner. This program was produced by Camcat Publishing. Copyright 2022 by Colin Holmes. Production copyright 2022 by Camcat Publishing. All rights reserved. For more information on all our books, visit www.camcatpublishing.com. If you liked what you just heard, please consider leaving us a review. Thank you for listening.
I always wondered what was out there in Area 51. Sure, the government says it's just a super secret base surrounding a highly classified aerospace research facility, but now we all know the truth, don't we? All the answers lie at the end of Thunder Road. Want to know more about the story? Or about the author, Colin Holmes? He has some interesting background tidbits to the story. So don't forget to subscribe to Camcat Unwrapped. If you don't want to miss a beat, listen now on the audiobook platform of your choice. All our books are also available in print and ebook formats on camcatbooks.com or wherever books are sold. Before you go, please take a moment to leave us a review on your preferred podcast platform. Thank you so much. Camcat Unwrapped also offers other Camcat books as podcasts. And check out our interviews with authors, editors, and other bookworms, as well as our background episodes, where we unwrap exclusive content related to our books. Tune in again to Camcat Unwrapped, because Camcat Unwrapped is where book lovers meet.